Thank you so much for your lecture. We have now more than 20 minutes for discussion, and I invite you to ask your questions using the microphone that Maximilian Katofina, one of our brightest first year students, will kindly bring you after you have seized your hand. I already identify the first question, Thomas Walmick. Thank you.
Mobilized in his political work and used against Luther. And what these Jesuits, the Jesuits have particularly mobilized it, so Juan de Salas, Luis de Molina, Gabriel Vasquez, who are a Cajun member, that's by the way. There are a whole cluster, Lesius. There are a cluster of theologians around the De Auxiliis controversy, so that second moment. So here is an internal, for those of you who are not familiar with this, there's an internal Catholic controversy between Jesuit proponents of free will and Thomist, defenders of the original Thomist position on free will. And it's bitter and violent, and in the end, the Pope just tells them to just cut it out, because So I think that, and it's these authors who are mobilising it, so I think there's a distinct crossover between the theology of grace and this moral possibility condition, and that's why I gave you the... here's the Salas quote. And Suarez has something very, very similar. And both Suarez and Salas... So in Thomas Aquinas, possibility is only a condition of human law. Well, it turns out to be a condition of divine law, but when it's introduced in the Treatise de Legibus, it's initially a question about human law. But both Salas and Suarez put it right at the beginning of their book, it's a condition of any law, divine law. So yes, I do think it's inflected by that. So, but these are the people who have read... Among the, you know, if you look up Grotius's citations, they're all to these people. There's a Soto, Lesius, Vasquez, not Salas really so much, but Suarez. I mean, so these are the people whose works then cross over into the Protestant tradition. Not all Jesuits use it at all. Not even all Jesuits don't use it, is what I'm saying. So it's a particular theological inflection. But what there is there's a kind of cluster of sub-questions associated with the possibility condition. So one is popular acceptance a condition of law? So if a population finds that the law's a bit too hard, can they sort of say no? And so we find it discussed in context even by people who are not mobilising this. So I think it's got a kind of penumbra, but certainly the theoretical articulation, I think, is distinctly connected with that theology of grace and a certain idea of human agency. Yeah. So that was the first question. Yeah, so the second question. Well, I think you must have read Hal Hochul's book on the Society of Jesus and the State. So he thinks that there's a kind of crossover, and actually Adam Constant is a good example. So Adam Constant's Politica, in some sense, it's a kind of piece of Jesuit reason of state, and he would become the confessor to Maximilian I of Bavaria. So this is somebody who, it's not pure academic theology, it's not in the academic genre De Legibus, but what he has is a section within it when he's talking about how a prince should legislate, but then reproduces all this stuff. So I think that they were capable of moving quite fluidly between genres, and Herr Höppel's thesis is that that kind of fluidity is part of it, that we shouldn't see a sort of Jesuit reason of state on the one hand, the kind of confessional moral theology, the advice to princes, and the academic theology, De Legibus, on the other. They are different genres, but these people, it's a continuing conversation. So I would want to... although I do think that the specific academic form and the specific crossover with the theology of grace is obviously not in the Politica works, I do think that it's part of a broader hinterland of moral theology. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just have a very short question. Did you observe some context with the Orthodox world in this time, in the 17th century?
So, that is a very interesting question. And my answer is no, but that might be because I wasn't looking for it. And that would say something about my paradigm of inquiry as a whole. So, no, they're obsessed, most of these people, with, you know, you've got the Turk on the one hand, I mean, they're very interested, obviously, in the Americas, all of these people, that's another dimension. And in various types of Protestant Reformation. But, yeah, it would be good to think some more about that.
I'm sure there were some contexts.
I think it's partly the way that I'm sort of mindset on this, because I would really like, my latest research, for those who've been taking me closer towards the Bohemian cataract measure, for example, and I'd really like to press on that a bit more, and I think that that will take me in the direction that you're talking about. So it's a kind of no, but that's my problem.
Yeah, thank you very much for this very rich presentation with lots of things to connect to. I have one question, but before I let me just make a very small remark on what you quoted in the end on torture as taking away agency. I think in the early modern, both juridical practice and theory, torture was precisely not about taking away agency.
Yes.
So that's a very huge difference today's dictatorial ruling to use torture. So in this argument, it's not yours, I recognize it, it just doesn't show. But I have a very basic question. I'm more familiar with the debate on tyranny and the right of resistance in the period you're studying.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether in the sources you study or the way you reflect on it, who are the people who are entitled to this kind of being preserved from cruelty, from asking too much, from asking the impossible? Who benefits from this law of possibility, because slaves probably don't, children don't, do women do? I know when we debate in the debate on resistance to tyranny, women to a certain extent are implied, at least noble women, I should say to be more precise, so I would be interested in hearing a little bit about the scope of people who are the subject and who can have this kind of agency
when added to
that.
Yeah. Great. So, I completely agree that in the early modern period it wasn't seen as torture, was not, which is precisely why it's not seen as cruel or inhuman in the same way. Whereas it is cruel or inhuman to stop a prisoner from trying to escape. And, but I suppose I was trying to suggest that we can't see that. I mean, that to us is a very strange way of thinking, and that I was trying to suggest that the way that, well, I suppose we particularly engaged in general order and see it work, but the way that we think about, we would think of torture as taking away agency. And it has to be said that in the early modern, so not with these Jesuits, but let's say with Thomas Hobbes, you know, he says somebody under torture can say anything. These Jesuits tend to insist that you've got to keep telling the truth, precisely because it's not taking away your agency, right? And so it would be a sin for you to lie under torture to save yourself from more torture. And Hobbes says, well, you know, somebody under torture can say, you know, that, I mean, they can say whatever, but he still doesn't outlaw torture. So I suppose I wanted to suggest that although we would draw the parameters of what doesn't take away agency differently, this kind of idea that something is inhuman if it destroys psychological integrity in that way is something that the contour of application is completely different, because we can't see why it doesn't apply to torture. But there's some resonance there with the way that we think today. So the space of resistance, really interesting. So I suppose in this current project I'm engaging, yes, the liberty of subjects, but who are subject exactly? So Grotius is interesting in the sense that it's not, and Hobbes too, that it's not just individuals, but it's also groups that can resist in certain circumstances. Slaves, no, although there's, in my last book, Changes of State, there's quite an interesting literature on escaping slaves. But it wouldn't be an injustice, obviously, to them to stop them escaping, although they do argue that once they've got, you know, they've escaped, then they've recovered it. Yeah, so. Women, so. This is where I would like to do some more work on this, but let's say Taylor on women. I mean, the casuistry is full of cases of women and being compelled and what counts as coercion and what doesn't. So Jeremy Taylor is quite sympathetic to the degree of precarity to which women are subject, which means that their exposure to catastrophic loss of everything, their honour, their goods, even their life, is greater than men's. And so this is the casuistry of conscience, so it's protecting these women in conscience, but it essentially gives them a greater latitude than a man would have in a similar situation. So my argument here is provisional. But provisionally, yes, there is a gendered dimension to this, that yeah, once again I need to do more work on this, kind of specifically reading for gender, but yeah, I would say that it does. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much indeed, Emma, for this lecture. I guess I have broader questions. It seems to me, it's my understanding, that this moral possibility condition is strictly tied up with the interests of the state, that there is agency to an extent, but only within the framework, as you mentioned, of the state. And therefore I'm wondering, despite their theological concerns, how, to what extent are these arguments attempts at legitimizing the, let's say, interpretive power of the sovereign, or legitimizing the extended power of the state?
Yeah.
And secondly, the variant on that question would be, indeed, how can we trace, it's perhaps beyond the scope of this lecture, but how can we trace affiliation, let's say, between this idea of the moral possibility within the state and what comes, in fact, later in the 18th century with Kant, of a moral imperative which is grounded on interpersonal relations rather than that of citizen and the state.
Yeah, okay. So I had to concentrate on this lecture on, so this is thank you for the question, because it enables me to cover the other dimension of possibility, which is possible according to custom. So the individual natural possibility, I agree, it's a very, very restricted scope. So you could say, great, this suits absolutist, that's absolutely fine, because life enhances. You can resist at the limits, but, you know, good luck to you. You're unlikely to win. Although it has to be said that in the casuistry of true liberty, you know, he allows a group of guilty men to defend themselves against the sovereign. So, you know, may a group of men do so, certainly, if they do but defend their lives. So Ambrosius, when he's considering private resistance, also allows groups to. So it's not without threat to an absolutist construction. But I absolutely take your point. You could say all of these people are absolutists and look. Doesn't seem right. So, interesting about Suarez is, so the other dimension, this is possible according to custom. So this is a collective, by definition, a collective sense of what's morally possible and what's not. And Suarez has a very interesting question, and it's related to one I talked about earlier, which is whether popular acceptance is necessary for law. So he now allows a community collectively. Supposing, you know, you had a community and collectively they thought that a law was too hard. It's not against God's law, so it wouldn't be wrong to obey this law, but it's too hard, it's too burdensome, it would impose a great cost. Well, he allows people in that community to temporise, to kind of look around at their neighbours, see what they're doing, and in the meantime not obey the law. So there is a kind of space for subject agency here, that on the grounds of this kind of too hard, this too hard language, it's too difficult, it's too much, sacrifice is too great. And that can open up, as far as I can see, in any form of constitution. I mean, Suárez himself, his preferred constitution is absolute monarchy, but it would still be the same. Interestingly, this is coming back to your question, theologians of the Bohemian Counter-Reformation are much, much less happy about that Suárez has a kind of majoritarian argument going on, that if the majority don't obey the law, then it isn't law. And theologians working in Prague say, what are you talking about? The law is the law, it obliges this kind of popular resistance. You know, Sylvia Wells, they don't quite say this explicitly, but this is the implication. Suárez was talking in Spain, this is the heartland of the Counter-Reformation. We are in Bohemia. You know, and we are not going to allow any kind of pushback. So I think it is, you don't want to necessarily call it democracy, but it can open up a space for kind of what we would call a kind of informal constitutionalism. It's not a constitution that's formalized in the law, but it is a way of acting that is recognized in law as a legitimate form of expressing resistance or disobedience or, yeah. So that would be my reply to the first one. The second one, affiliation, so how does it go to Kant and impersonal relations?
Interpersonal.
I mean, my instinctive argument is, well, not at all.
My point was, how do we, what is the devil of the decades?
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. Well, so I think that possibility arguments. I do think that these tropes of too burdensome, inhuman, cruel, do form part of a kind of nascent rights of man type language in the 18th century. So there's work that's done, for example, on religious persecution, which I think are essentially possibility arguments. With Hugo de Galisteo, for example, Catherine Arnold's work on that. So, and eventually, if you look at, again, this is embryonic work for me because I haven't really tracked it into the 18th century, but looking at memoirs of freed slaves, for example, Frederick Douglass, talking about the psychological unbearability, that it's not simply the fact that you're in chains as a slave, because not every slave is in chains, but it's still psychologically unbearable. But I would have thought this had nothing to do with a kind of interpersonal. I think it's a political argument. I don't think it's a moral argument in any kind of Kantian sense. I mean, it's a different way of thinking about the moral, and therefore a different way of thinking about the political. The subject upon whom this kind of psychological pressure is brought, I think it's not the same as the kind of Kantian subject of ethics in any recognizable way. So I would think that it didn't go into that tradition of moral at all, which isn't to say that it's not worth making sure it's said that.
Yes, thank you very much. Got me thinking, because the political actors, I'm familiar with the political states.
Yes.
All the time, yeah. They say what you demand is,
yes,
impossible,
exactly.
To
yes.
The law, the tax demands, the law,
yeah.
We can't do it. But now I've realized when demanding the impossible is tyranny. Does it follow then that talking about the impossible is a way of implicitly saying your law is a tyrant? So is this, and it's quite persuasive, that means, so is this language of the impossible maybe also a very strong and maybe dangerous form of criticizing your Lord?
Yes, that is my hunch. That because it is centrally associated with, it's got this biblical anchor that everybody knows about, an accusation that it's impossible, and you're right, tax is a key site for impossibility arguments, and would continue to be so. So I look briefly at the tax surrounding Stamp Act crisis in the American 18th century. It's all grievous, it's burdensome, it's tyranny, but it's grievous, burdensome, it's impossible, we cannot do it. Effectively, it's a warning, I think, you know, if you carry on doing this, but of course you're not going to, Lauren Benton, who's working in the Jesuits in Paraguay, she found an example precisely of that, of Jesuits using the language of the impossible to protest the treaty between Spain and Portugal to remove the only from one side of the river to another. So yeah, I do think it is a language. It's one of those languages where you're not quite saying that someone is a tyrant, but it's going in that direction. And yeah, and you tax everywhere. That's a side of this kind of argument. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Deborah, for answering all these questions. I think they're very important. To round up what you wanted to say, may I remember that tonight is recording, that you can listen to it afterwards on the homepage of the Short Actors. So, thank you once again. Have a good evening, and if you were so lucky to be on the eve of your 96th birthday, mentally and physically. It's such a good condition as Gerald Schwitz is today, I believe, for his own 96th birthday. Well, I congratulate you already now. So I'm not sure about myself. So thank you all, and see you next year.